This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. During the Second World War, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt visited the Army Parachute School at Fort Benning, Georgia, and asked, "Where are your Negro paratroopers?" The still segregated U.S. Army had already formed all-black infantry and tank units, but African-American soldiers were largely relegated to non-combat duties, and the jump boots, wings, and bloused trousers of the elite parachute regiments were off-limits. Shortly after the president's pointed question, the Army started a black airborne test platoon that expanded into the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, the Triple Nickels. As the war was ending in Europe, the unit's mission was changed. The Triple Nickels became the Army's first smoke jumpers and battled Japanese balloon bombs in the forests of California and the Pacific Northwest. Bradley Biggs was the first officer selected for that unit. He later wrote a history called The Triple Nickels. He joins us now from Chicago. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
In the segregated army that you joined before the Second World War, what were your options?
Very few. I was with the 372nd Infantry, and we were stationed in Brooklyn, guarding bridges, of all things. And I asked myself one day, is this where I'm going to spend my military career? Because I always wanted to be an Army officer. And I said, no way. So I went off to Officer Candidate School and got a commissioned Second Lieutenant of Infantry. And from then on, I said, well, let's get where the action is. But like most of the men who came to join us, they want to be recognized as soldiers, which is their citizenship and democratic right and privilege.
And soldiers who did more than drive trucks or
who did more than drive trucks or pass ammunition. They wanted to do something differently. They didn't want to go into an organization that handled ammunition or rations or swept the streets or grave registration. They wanted to be where the action was. And that's what our spirit and morale was based upon. Men who wanted the action. And we got them.
Since you guys were the first blacks in parachute school, all of the men who trained you, by definition, had to be white. Did they make it hard on you?
A few did. One of the questions that struck us was, how are we going to deal with the white instructors who are questioning who is going to train the black paratroopers? Now, can you imagine being assigned to a duty, risky as parachuting is, working under an instructor who doubted that you could really do the job? Hmm. So we said, well, we're going to ignore that and go on and do it anyway. And we said, under no circumstance are any of us going to quit. We're going to jump out that 34-foot tower if we have to do it without a harness. And Cal Cunha said, well, jump out that airplane without a parachute if need be. Of course, he didn't mean that, but that was the spirit and the attitude that we had.
Now, you ended up with more than 360 jumps, but I bet you remember that first one particularly well.
Yes.
What was it like?
There's some apprehension. You are graded on the manner in which you exit from the aircraft. You are graded also on the way you landed from the end of your parachute jump experience. You're also graded on a manner in which you control your chute in the air. So there's some apprehension. You're going to do the right things you've been trained because you're under scrutiny from the instructor in the airplane as well as an instructor on the ground. You want to make sure you did the right thing and did it right.
Now, when you jumped out that door the first time, did you look down?
Oh, absolutely. I was looking down, looking for the ground. And there was no fear, no consternation. But there's a very difficult, apprehension that you experience when you jump out of an airplane. But after a while, you get used to it and it becomes a matter of fact.
At the time, the bases at which you were training in Georgia, North Carolina, the conditions outside the base had to be difficult.
They were very difficult indeed, but we made a point to avoid the difficult spots. You don't look at a storm water and run into it just because it's there. You stay out of the trouble areas because you know there are going to be difficulties if you go into them. So we always told our men, and we practiced it ourselves, that if you're going to go to town, go where you want to go, comport yourself so that the police don't have to keep an eye on you. Don't allow yourself to get involved in fights or scrapes. And above all, don't get into encounters with the local police because they'll put you in jail and fine you in a minute.
One thing that made the Triple Nickels different from the other all-black units that were formed at about the same time was the fact that this unit was officered completely by blacks. That was extremely controversial because at that moment, you're putting black men, African-Americans, in the chain of command.
That was our great pride. that we're a black from commanding officer down to the lowest private. We did not have any white officers come in and tell us what to do. We knew what we had to do. We were prepared for it. We trained for it, and we performed the highest standards possible. We did not appreciate the fact that any white officers would come down and give us some ideas. We already had our own policies in place. And we knew that from our training, we had done exceedingly well, and having men follow in our footsteps, then they would also do well.
The official explanation, the Army's official explanation for not sending the Triple Nickels to fight in Europe was that the battalion was not up to full strength and they wanted to send a complete battalion. It didn't have the full complement of men. Do you buy that?
No, we did not buy that at all. We were as trained and as competent as any other white organization, airborne or otherwise. What we did face was a shortage of personnel, but we could have picked up more personnel overseas. Recall after the Battle of the Bulge, a request was made for Negro soldiers to volunteer to serve in white units, and they were what is called the 5th Platoon. We had some of those 5th Platoon members join us in the 555 after World War II. They were gladly a volunteer to serve with us if we were going overseas during World War II. So that argument just doesn't hold any water.
Why do you think you weren't sent?
We were not sent overseas because a new mission came up to send us out west to combat the Japanese balloon invasion, which many people thought was serious enough to keep us out of the fighting in Europe. And furthermore, the fight in Europe was taking a different turn, where the need for paratroopers was not as great as it had been.
So in April 1945, you're all put on a train to go to the West Coast. You arrive in Pendleton, Oregon, and you find out that you have a completely new mission.
We appreciated the fact that we were selected for a new mission. We did not know what it was until we got out to Oregon. By the way, the population of Oregon was only 2% black. And we faced a lot of discrimination when we arrived on the scene.
It was no better than Georgia?
No better than Georgia. We could not go into a hotel. The restaurants in town were not service. There's only one place in town where we could get a pool table to play pool on or to get a Coca-Cola.
Tell us about the balloon bombs. These were released by the Japanese from Japan, obviously, and then floated across the Pacific?
Yes, they were released from a base in Honshu, Japan, and they used the stratosphere to move them across the Pacific Ocean. They used the same air currents that our strategic bombers were later to use when they were practicing mission runs to bomb Russia. They would travel across the Pacific Ocean at a speed of about 100 to 185 miles per hour. And they had a very ingenious device on them that when they reached a certain altitude, the balloon would cool and lower itself to a warmer altitude where it would inflate and rise again. Now, before it would rise, a device would drop a sandbag, making the balloon lighter than it was when it left the island of Honshu. It would take about 3 days for one to get across the Pacific Ocean. And by the time it reached the West Coast, all the sandbags had been dropped. The balloon was weighted with a bomb or incendiary bombs so that the weight of it would land into a wooded area, explode, or detonate.
I'm speaking with Bradley Biggs. He's the author of The Triple Nickels, America's first all-black paratroop unit, a unit in which he served during the Second World War and afterwards. Eventually, the Japanese stopped sending balloon bombs, and the Triple Nickels were called back to the East Coast and absorbed into the 82nd Airborne Division, and you got to march down Fifth Avenue in New York City in the great parade celebrating the end of the Second World War.
Yes, that was General Gavin's doing. General Gavin was colorblind. He had always been a proponent of integration, having served with black troops, and he knew what they could do. So he took the battalion under his wing, had us put on the 82nd Airborne Division patch, and marched down Fifth Avenue with the 82nd Airborne Division. That was a wonderful, wonderful gesture. And that really gave us an awful lot of good morale, things to talk about.
There was also an incident that happened to the Triple Nickels in addition to the parade in Manhattan in New York City. There were other, you know, of course, celebrations, but there were also a lot of training exercises that you guys went on, and one of them happened at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, and I was wondering if you could tell us that story.
That was not really the 550th Parachute Infantry Battalion. as an organization. It was the personnel from the 555, and we had already been integrated into the 82nd Airborne Division. Now, we went into Eglin Air Force Base Operation as a major ground force unit. And one day, while we were in the preparatory to going to the ground operation after we made our jump, a flight of B-29 bombers was off course, and they dropped their bombs on the tank company and our battalion, which was in the staging area.
Live bombs?
Live 29 bombs from 10,000 feet. We lost a half a dozen men, about a dozen or so were wounded. The tankers lost 5 or 6 men and several people wounded.
Accidents happen in training exercises as well as in warfare. Friendly fire does happen. But this incident, you write in your book, was never really investigated.
The investigation was done by the Army, was swept under the rug. A small article appeared in the newspaper somewhere in Florida, and that was it. When I talked with the battalion commander, the squadron commander, he said, well, my navigator said he was on course and on target, and he let his bombs go at the right point. And that just shut up the whole case.
So nothing ever happened? Nobody
nothing
was ever...
Nothing ever happened?
No one has ever held
responsible? Nobody was ever punished?
Did you ever find out why not?
No, we never did. It was closed case, and we had to go let it go at that. What more could we do?
Do you think, I just have to ask the question, do you think it would have been swept under the rug if those bombs had fallen on white troops?
It would not have been swept under the rug. They would have been hit in the newspapers because the press was never favorable where black troops were concerned in any war. But if they were white soldiers, the white press would have been out there looking at what's going on, and they would have carried on that investigation until they got something done.
What would you say is the legacy of the Triple Nickels?
We persevered in the face of being programmed for defeat. We want the plebes at West Point, the midshipmen at Annapolis, the cadets at the Air Force Academy, to read what we have done and how we did it. And if they can do that and understand the perseverance that went through our ranks and that we felt in terms of pride, and also not only just pride, but loyalty to our country, that they'd be more prone to feel the same way about their country. The whole nation needs to hear our story of how we persevered in the face of opposition from everyone who did not believe that the Negro paratrooper could survive. And we did survive with great firsts and great accomplishments, more than any other Army unit.
Thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us.
It's my responsibility and obligation to do so.
Bradley Biggs' book about America's first all-black paratroop unit is still in print. It's called The Triple Nickels. Coming up, Ed Ward remembers one of rock and roll's mother roads, Beale Street. This is Fresh Air.